And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. The Harriet Beecher Stowe House Fall Discussion Series is back this week with a look at two works its namesake author researched while writing Uncle Tom's Cabin. And joining Cincinnati Edition to talk about it are Xavier University Professor Emeritus Dr. John Goetz. Welcome, John.
Hey, good to be here.
And the past president of the Friends Association of the Stowe House, Chris DeSimio. Welcome, Chris.
It's always a pleasure to be here.
We usually have you on talking financial issues, but you are a Renaissance man, I suppose.
Oh, Renaissance guy, maybe.
But... Join our conversation if you're listening, 513-419-7100. Email talk at wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and your tweets and your questions there and try to get some of those into the show as well. So before we jump into details about this lecture series that's back for its third year, the Harriet Beecher Stowe House, I think we should just start with some elementary background. I think most of us could probably answer some sort of Jeopardy question about who wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin or vice versa, but I'm not sure everyone truly knows the connection to Cincinnati. So what is Harriet Beecher Stowe and her history to Cincinnati?
Well, one thing we say at the house is she could not have written Uncle Tom's Cabin if she hadn't spent 18 years here in Cincinnati. She moved with her father in 1832 to Cincinnati, and his house, the family homestead, is the house, the Harriet Beecher Stowe House, today. So in her 18 years in Cincinnati, from 1832 to 1850, she encountered slavery in a way that she never would have had she stayed back in New England. And so many experiences here went into the shaping of her mindset that enabled her to write Uncle Tom's Cabin right after she left Cincinnati and moved to Maine.
There were some recent race riots in Cincinnati just prior to her arrival in 1832. Is that correct?
The 1829 one, I believe, was the biggest one. It drove away more than half of the free black population at the time.
What was the catalyst for it?
Well, economic for the most part. There was fear that there would be fewer jobs available if former slaves came to Cincinnati. There was fear the population of free blacks at the time grew from like 2% of Cincinnati's population 10 years prior to almost 10%. So it was this sense that this was getting bigger and that it was going to get worse. So that it was already very difficult for free blacks to live in Ohio in general, and in Cincinnati in particular. They were always subject to being captured. I mean, it could have happened easily and accused of being a fugitive, which they weren't. They had to carry papers. They had to keep money on deposit. They had to put up $500 of bond to guarantee their good behavior.
Wow.
They weren't allowed to send their kids to public schools. They weren't allowed to testify in court against a white person. It was a tough thing to do to be here anyway. And the riots, they wanted just the white population wanted to encourage them to leave. And so more than half did.
It's so interesting when you explore Cincinnati's geographic history in America's racist slavery past, because Kentucky being a slave state and Cincinnati sort of being that front door to freedom. But when you dive in more deeply, you do find that it wasn't all good once you cross the river.
No, and it was, pretty much a pro-slavery city, really, because of the active trade with the South.
Well, in New Orleans. Yeah. I mean, if you admire the beautiful grill work in the French Quarter in New Orleans, that stuff was made here, that cast iron that was made here in the Cincinnati area. Those riverboats were going down to New Orleans. That was the port that ended up receiving a lot of the products made here in Cincinnati. After the Civil War, Harriet wrote, she kept writing, and one of her books, Great Men of Our Times, in her chapter on Salmon P. Chase, she says that over half of the loans, commercial loans made by banks in Cincinnati prior to the Civil War, used slaves as collateral.
Wow.
Wow is right.
And of course, we have just before you came in, the dean of the Chase mm-hmm. College. We have the law school now, of course, named for Salmon P. Chase, whom she met at a place called the Semicolon Club. Can you give me, I've never heard of this until I started preparing for this segment. Harriet Beecher Stowe came to town and met some literary figures and some academic types at a place called the Semicolon Club, which doesn't sound like a lot of fun, but there were some pretty prominent names there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they got together every Monday night and would drink a little wine, do a little dancing, and read things, letters from back in the East, civilization, and get together and also read things that they wrote themselves. And a lot of them were just kind of witty pieces. And but it was here that Harriet actually discovered herself as a creative writer at the Semicolon Club.
A sort of a precursor to like the Cincinnati Literary
Society. The Semicolon Club actually allowed women to join.
Except the Cincinnati one of today does not allow women to join.
Harriet's sister, Catherine Beecher, was a member. Her uncles, the Foote brothers, who were her mother's brothers, they were held at their home, Samuel and John Foote. They would alternate. Daniel Drake was a member. It was the peak of Cincinnati society.
How did Harriet Beecher Stowe develop an empathy towards African Americans and slaves?
Well, her 18 years in Cincinnati enabled her to talk to people on the Underground Railroad, the Rankin family particularly, Presbyterian ministers. John Rankin was a Presbyterian minister, like Harriet's father, Lyman Beecher. And that's from them, actually, she heard the story that turned into Eliza crossing the ice in Uncle Tom's Cabin. So she met people on the Underground Railroad. She met people who held slaves, people who were very active abolitionists. And a key event for her, something that always strikes me about Harriet, in 1849, her baby son died of cholera, 18 months old. Was her favorite kid, the one who ate and slept when he was supposed to, did all the endearing things to her. And he dies, and she writes at that a couple of years later, reflecting on it, she said, "I learned at that moment what a slave mother feels like when her child is taken away from her."
Yeah.
She couldn't have written that back in 1832 when she came to Cincinnati, but by 1849, her heart had been opened in a way that she could have that act of empathy, even in this very sad moment for her.
Yeah, and it's amazing how long she kept these mental files, and they were probably written down as well. But she saw a slave auction in the summer of 1833. She came here as a teacher in her sister's school. During the summer, everyone would leave town to escape the cholera epidemic they were afraid would revisit. So she went to Washington, Kentucky, south of Maysville, and there was reported to have seen a slave auction with children being separated, families being separated, children from their parents. And her friend who was with her said that she was extraordinarily quiet. She was just taking it all in and kept that bottled up for 17 years until her own son passed away, killed by prejudice as much as by cholera, because a cure for cholera, a prevention of cholera, had already been described by someone who lived in Cincinnati in 1832, a former slave, said, if you boil the water before you drink it, let it cool, boil it, let it cool, and then drink it, you won't get sick. But his advice was ignored by doctors, including Dr. Drake, because he wasn't, not only was he not a doctor, he was a former slave.
Stowe's family had a role in the Underground Railroad?
Well, Chris could handle that better than I could.
There's a lot of conjecture. If you were involved in the Underground Railroad, you didn't like post it on Facebook or anything because you were breaking the law and you'd go to jail. But it's fairly well known. There's enough iterations of this story about how one of her housekeepers, domestic help. She always needed domestic help. She had, seven kids, six of them here in Cincinnati. They were always, she was always scrambling to make ends meet. And one of them, she thought was a freed slave, but in fact, turns out was a fugitive. And when they heard that they were coming to get her, her brother, Henry Ward Beecher, and husband, Calvin Stowe, are reported to have whisked her away to the home of John Van Zandt.
So in 1852, Uncle Tom's Cabin was released. This is the book that she's most widely known for.
In book form.
In book form, yes. Okay. So this was a sensation, right? This was a huge, huge deal when it was released. Yeah. Briefly, give us like the elevator pitch for those of us who've been out of high school for a while, what this book was about.
Well, it's an appeal to the emotions of the audience. Stowe said, the arguments are out there against slavery. People know those. They haven't worked, apparently. I'm going to paint pictures that will touch people's hearts, that will reach their emotions. And that's what she does through the book, following. The book moves on two trajectories, really. One is Uncle Tom, the title character, who goes deeper and deeper into the South as a slave, not through his own volition at all, but he gets to worse and worse plantations as he goes south. And then the other trajectory of the book is George Harris, who is a runaway slave, the husband of Eliza, who crossed the ice, and they move toward freedom to the North.
Okay, so it was so popular and influential that it's been said that President Abraham Lincoln, I guess he may have met the
we know
author.
They met.
Yes.
He did meet.
So they met, and he's quoted, this may be legend, but he's quoted as saying, so this is the little lady who started this great war, that this book had a role in.
Yeah, we don't know if he really said that, but we do know that they met around Thanksgiving time or early December of 1862, because she went to Washington to lobby for the Emancipation Proclamation to push him to really go forward with that on January 1st.
That's right. She wanted to hold him to it and make sure that he didn't go back on that promise of emancipation.
In the work that she underwent in producing Uncle Tom's Cabin, she researched some works that were already written, and she conducted that work here in Cincinnati. And that's the focus of Wednesday's launch of the lecture series. We've got information on this at WVXU.org. The two pieces are Theodore Dwight Weld and Angelina and Sarah Grimke, American Slavery as It Is, Testimony of a Thousand Witnesses. That was written in 1839. And you also have Life of Josiah Henson, formerly a slave, now an inhabitant of Canada. I believe that's a biography, an autobiography. And these are the two pieces that she used to work on her book. So tell us what, let's start with the first one, American Slavery as It Is. What is this?
Probably one of the very first ever, like, social media. It was a viral outreach. They asked their friends and acquaintances to send them their reminiscences, if they had been in the South, of what their firsthand experience with slavery was. So those poured in. They went to the New York Commercial Reading Room. Weld did. They were living and working in the New York area at the time, and got 2 years' worth of newspapers from New Orleans, Charleston, all throughout the South. They counted it up when they were done. 6 months later, going through these newspapers, looking at court cases, looking at the ads, using the slave owner's own words to indict them, really, they figured they went through 20,000 newspapers. But the descriptions of fugitive slaves in the ads are horrifying. There's no reason to go into it. It's lunchtime now. But at the slavehold, they use the slaveholder's own words to paint what a horrible thing slavery was. And it was a blockbuster in its own right. It sold about 100,000 copies in 1839.
And Josiah Henson, tell us about his work in 1849.
He was a slave born, we should say first, these aren't the only works that she researched at all for the book. She read Frederick Douglass's narrative, all sorts of other things, but we chose to focus on these two. Henson was born into slavery in Maryland, and eventually he was betrayed by his owner, who he thought had allowed him to buy his freedom, and then the owner changed the deal without really telling him. And he eventually made his escape to Canada, where he became the guiding spirit for the Dawn Settlement of many runaway slaves up in Canada. What the connection with Uncle Tom, I think, that's particularly relevant is the moral dilemmas that he faced as a slave, and the different ways that he resolved them. in A Key to Uncle Tom's Cabin, which she wrote in 1853 as a kind of defense of her picture of slavery in Uncle Tom's Cabin. And again, another work where she amassed all sorts of data to prove that, if anything, she was too easy on slavery. So in there, she gives a plot summary of Henson's life and focuses on a moral moment where he is about to kill his master and go to his freedom. But he backs away because of his Christianity, and that particularly appealed to Stowe and helped her to build Uncle Tom as a Christian hero.
How will these be explored in the lecture series that launches on Wednesday?
Well, the same way we always explore things in the lecture series. I'll have a timeline and a handout with some key excerpts from the book. But we'll start by trying to get the reactions of the people who are there, who have read the stuff, and see what they want to talk about, and then go from there. It's a genuine discussion. It's not really a lecture series.
You do have more lecture series coming up throughout the year, and in October, the series continues with an exploration of the Stowe House and possible hauntings. Can you tell us about some ghost stories that might be
lingering? Have any ghost stories about the house. Maybe Chris does, but this is images of the South as a haunted
house.
Okay. In Stowe, in Uncle Tom's Cabin, and then also The Fall of the House of Usher, and another story that was written after the Civil War. And Kristen Renzi, one of my colleagues from Xavier, will be joining us that night as a co-discussion leader.
November, the series moves to Indicting the North. And this is kind of what we were touching on with Cincinnati, right? It's that the Union states were far from perfect in terms of racial equality. So what are we going to learn when we indict the North in November?
Well, we'll look at a couple of moments in Uncle Tom's Cabin where Harriet indicts the North. She does not see herself as just putting all the blame on the South at all. And then we'll also read Henry David Thoreau's Slavery in Massachusetts, where he does the very same thing, saying, hey, complicity, you're involved in this too. Don't just put it all on the South.
December, we've got a Christmas story that Harriet Beecher Stowe wrote, and you will contrast that with descriptions of Christmas for enslaved persons by Frederick Douglass and Harriet Jacobs. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, they have interesting reflections on Christmas. Sometimes the masters would give some time off between Christmas and New Year's in the hopes that the slaves would get drunk. They kind of encouraged that. And they, as a way of trying to keep them in their place and diffuse ideas about rebellion or running away.
Why do you think the book Uncle Tom's Cabin still resonates?
Well, I think because we talk at Beecher Stowe House about sustaining Harriet's legacy. I think the issues that Harriet dealt with in that book are still very much with us. Not slavery per se in the United States, but all sorts of racism and social injustice issues are still very much with us. And we look at the formation of Harriet's social conscience. How did she change from a colonizationist, as she was when she came to Cincinnati, to the abolitionist position that she took in writing the book? And that can be a lesson for everybody about opening their minds and hearts.
It resonates, too, because of the deeply personal nature of what she wrote. When she's writing about the Eliza with the little boy running away and stopping at the home of a senator and the senator's wife, Mrs. Byrd, she's writing about herself. The physical description of Mrs. Byrd is Harriet. And she's writing about giving away the toys that belonged to her baby who had just passed away. If you can't, if you don't cry when you read that book, when you read that kind of that part, there's something wrong with you.
What do you think is the general takeaway for someone visiting the Stowe House for the first time?
I hope it's inspiration. I hope that people who visit the Stowe House realize that anyone can make a huge difference. She was told that she couldn't make a difference because of her gender, because she wasn't the oldest. She was one of the youngest children. She had all these reasons, very good reasons, why she couldn't have made a difference. But she made a huge difference. So that's in the walls there.
The Harriet Beecher Stowe House Lecture Series starts on Wednesday. Full details at WVXU.org inside the Cincinnati Edition tab. I want to thank Dr. John Goetz and Friends Association at the Harriet Beecher Stowe House, past president Chris DeSimio, for coming in and telling us a little bit
about
it.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Thanks.
Up next, it's time for the annual Swim Across the Ohio River. Are you ready? That's next on Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. I'm Michael Monks. Subscribe to our podcast at WVXU.org.